Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
At 6:30 a.m., June 21st, 2004, Jim Donnelly parks his car in the staff car park at the Glenbrook Steel Mill, southwest of Auckland, New Zealand. Jim makes his way up to his office, where he places his lunch on the bench and retrieves his work clothes from his locker. At 7:30 a.m, a colleague sees Jim on a nearby gantry. When Jim failed to show for a 9 a.m. meeting, the alarm was raised, and a significant police and rescue effort was underway within hours. But Jim was never seen again. 5 days later, Jim's hard hat was found next to a vat of acid. The vat was drained, where his work keys, Palm Pilot, and ID cards were discovered, but no human remains nor any other trace of Jim has ever been found. 18 years later, the case remains one of New Zealand's most high-profile missing persons cases. The bizarre series of events leading up to the disappearance, combined with the tight-lipped mill management, only fueling the fire of the mystery. Countless articles, TV documentaries, and police detectives have tried but failed to answer the one enduring question. What happened to Jim Donnelly?
It's violence that may disturb some people.
Today we can officially announce that New Zealand Steel has cracked the code.
On the 21st of June 2004, scientist Jim Donnelly vanished from his work at the Glenbrook Steel.
From Brevity Studios in New Zealand, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt.
There was nothing in the early days to indicate that we were looking for somebody who had been any misadventure.
Hands and knees, and you don't know what you're going to find. It started off as a joke, and then it got rather scary.
I just ask if anybody out there has any information that can help me put this victim home.
On August 21st, 2007, Auckland coroner Sam Herdson sat at her desk and began to type her findings in relation to James Carl Donnelly, following an inquest into his bizarre June 2004 disappearance from the Glenbrook Steel Mill in Waiuku, New Zealand. This finding would confirm what most already believed, but now, in the eyes of the law, Sam Herdson would officially declare James dead. Yet this finding would not answer the two most important questions of all. How and why? The case would become one of New Zealand's most enduring mysteries. Rumours would swirl, yet nothing would stick. And to this day, no person has ever come forward with any information in relation to Jim's disappearance. The official finding simply stating, cause and location unknown. My name's Ryan Wolfe. I'm an actor and a lawyer, and in this season of Guilt, I'm going to investigate the disappearance of James Donnelly, better known as Jim, with the goal of finally piecing together the puzzle to uncover what really happened to Jim on the morning of June 21st, 2004. I'll revisit the truly bizarre timeline of events leading up to Jim's disappearance and speak to people who have never been spoken to before. And as in season one, I want you to be part of this investigation. If you have any information related to Jim's disappearance, strange goings on at the mill, or you believe you saw Jim around the time of his disappearance, or any time since, please contact us. You'll find the contact details in the show notes of this episode. I believe the truth to what happened to Jim lies somewhere in his odd behavior in the days leading up to his disappearance. And over the course of this podcast, I'm going to investigate every aspect of these events in depth and progressively eliminate all the different theories until we're left with the clearest possible picture and hopefully an answer to this 18-year mystery. However, this case isn't only about the events of those few days. It's also the story of Jim Donnelly, the son, the brother, the husband, and the father. We'll speak to those who were closest to Jim about the man he was and the hole he's left behind. But first, we need to paint a picture of the town that is Waiuku and the story of the steel mill that's its beating heart. Before we start, I'd like you to take a moment to do two things. The first, and most important, is to hit the follow button. That's the plus symbol if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, and the follow button on Spotify. This is going to be an extended, multi-episode podcast. New episodes will sometimes be released at random intervals. Following is completely free, and clicking this button will ensure that you receive a notification the moment each new episode becomes available. Secondly, if you enjoy this podcast, make sure you give it a 5-star review. Both of these things greatly help others find the podcast, which in turn spreads the word and may ultimately help solve this case. And if you're really enjoying this podcast series, we now offer an Apple Plus subscription option where you can listen ad-free and also access bonus content which won't be included in the free podcast. You'll see these bonus episodes in the Guilt podcast on Apple Podcasts. If you click one of these, you'll be prompted to subscribe for roughly the price of a Coke, which gives you more episodes and also supports the podcast, which means I can produce more content. This is going to be a podcast largely broken into two halves. The first half, we're going to establish in detail who Jim Donnelly was and what exactly took place leading up to his disappearance. You'll hear from friends and family closest to Jim in those final days, as well as police in charge of the case. In the second half, we're going to look over the different possibilities and attempt to discount each one to leave us with the most likely scenario. You'll hear from people who have never spoken publicly before, and also we'll cover in depth new, previously unheard possibilities as to what happened to Jim. This is going to be a hell of a ride, so be patient, listen well, and for the first time in season 2 of Guilt, let's get into it. If you were to drive approximately 40 minutes southwest of New Zealand's largest city, Auckland, you'll find the small town of Waiuku. Population 9,500. The name Waiuku is indigenous Māori and is derived from the tale of two brothers, Tamakei and Tamako, and how they vied for the hand of a beautiful, high-ranking chieftainess. Tamakei was the cultivator, and Tamako the orator. Tamako, using his deft skills of persuasion, was the first to meet her, but she requested that Tamakei also be presented to her. As he'd been working in the fields, he had to be washed with water, or wai, and uku, a particular kind of mud from the stream that flows into the Manukau harbour. Upon meeting, it was Tamakei who won her heart, and as such, the place was named Waiuku. The town sits at the head of the Waiuku River, which, despite its name, is not really a river at all, and is in fact an estuarial arm of the Manukau Harbour 12 kilometres north. Because of this, the area is tidal, and has been used as a prominent portage by the local Māori for over 100 years before Europeans arrived and built a port in 1843. It was officially marked out as a town in 1851. And as I pull into the town, refreshingly, it still maintains some of its colonial charm. Okay, I'm just getting into Waiuku. A lot of roadworks at the moment. So I've been driving for about 20 minutes since Pukekohe. Now, Waiuku's sort of on the western side of the North Island, about 40 minutes south of Auckland. And I'm coming here now because actually I'm going to be going and meeting a historian at the Waiuku Museum, and they're going to sort of show me through the museum, and we're going to talk about the history of Waiuku so he can paint a bit of a picture of about this town and maybe how the steel mill fits into that. So just coming into the town, impressions are, it certainly has a bit of a sort of colonial kind of feel to it. I'm just driving past a big wooden homestead, almost get a feeling you're going back in time a little bit. There's a large wooden church in front of me. Yeah, certainly quite typical of many small New Zealand towns. The touches of sort of colonialism, some old buildings, you know, a little bit of that, and then combined with some newer stuff as well. Yeah, there's a nice big church up on the hill, which I assume has probably been there for a fair while. The town is sort of built around the Kentish Hotel, which is a very old hotel, which looks fantastic, and I spoke about earlier. Grand, two-story, painted in traditional colonial white with ornate verandas. It really presents as the historical heart of the town. It's calling my name to stop and sample a local pint, and I'll get to that. But first, I want to get a real sense of the history of Waiuku from the people that know it best. So I'm heading to the local Waiuku Museum, where they've happily agreed to open their doors on a Saturday and give me a personal tour of the museum and the story that made the town what it is today.
Tell you, if you go right back, I mean, this has been the pathway north and south in New Zealand for 1,000 years or more.
The Waiuku Museum is exactly what you would imagine a small town museum should be, and honestly, what every small museum should strive to be. It sits at the water's edge, a stone throw from the dock, and is packed to the rafters with everything from a giant 30-kilo block of kauri gum to the first piece of steel ever to come out of the Glenbrook Mill. It started its life as the old Waiuku Fire Station, and over the years has grown as its treasure trove of local and national pieces has increased, and is now made up of many different areas, combining multiple rooms, and even includes a life-size street scene, where you can see a selection of some of the original shops that lined the main street. Today, I'm getting a private tour of the museum, and learning the history of the area by director Richard Garvey and committee member Jane Thorne.
There were people living around the Manukau in at least in the 900s, possibly before that, but the earliest they've found is around 900 AD, and then there's a pass site just up down the estuary a bit from here, dates to around 1000 AD, so they would have all used this as the portage, and it was used right until Europeans came, and in fact it was still being used until the railway went through Pukekohe and managed to get down into the Waikato in 1880, and that of course completely killed the portage because then you had a railway line.
Of course.
So, yeah. So as a portage it was extremely important.
Yeah.
The wharf here was the second busiest inland port in New Zealand.
Wow.
At one stage. That's how much product was being brought up from the Waikato, you know, produce being grown down there and coming up to Auckland because of the town of Auckland growing.
If you're not familiar with New Zealand, Auckland is our largest city, with a current population of 1.6 million. Until the introduction of the railway, transferring goods north to Auckland by water via the wharf in Waiuku was far simpler than taking it overland through New Zealand's dense native bush. And while it doesn't look it now, in the mid-1800s was an extremely busy port. However, it was never an all-tide port, meaning that when the tide went out, large vessels couldn't dock.
How deep would this have been back? I mean, would they?
It was never all tide.
Yeah.
If it did come up with passengers, there was somewhere out, I don't know exactly where, out in the harbour there, there was a place where they could offload them and they get picked up by a horse and cart and brought into town.
Ah, right.
But I'm not 100% sure whether that was at the end of Maria Rahi Road or Tahuna or something like that. Except I thought they brought them across to the sands, but it doesn't quite make sense. But, yeah. So it was never all tide, but, yeah, it was enough. There was certainly enough deep water there.
It was enough for ships like the famous Weka to visit the port. And as the passengers on board approached the dock, one of the first buildings they would have seen, standing grandly, looking over the Waiuku River, is the famous Kentish Hotel, which apparently has one guest that you won't find in the guest book.
Developed, to be perfectly honest, but they surveyed it off with the idea there'd be a town there and a town here. But and that was in the early 1840s, 41, and that's when Constable, 51. That's when Constable arrived and decided that this was a good place for a hotel. So he built his hotel in 51, 52. Finally reneged and got a license in 53.
So it's the longest...
It's the oldest continually license. Operating pub in the country, yes.
One of the rooms apparently is haunted. Well,
a woman, yes. Occasionally someone reports seeing a woman walking across from one room to the bathrooms or something, long dress. So.
We make our way through the museum, and it doesn't take long to see the first evidence of the steel mill on the town. The first being a model given to the museum by NZ Steel, and the second being the very first piece of steel ever poured by the mill.
Glass cabinet.
Have these all just already been donated by people over time?
Yeah.
Although a lot of them came from, Shackleton? He was a keen model maker, so a lot of them he did, but others have come from various places. New Zealand Steel gave us that one, because that's a model of their boat they carry the iron ore from Taharawa.
What about NZ Steel? Do you know much about the history of that? And do you have much in here or anything about the history of that?
We have their very first piece of steel that they poured.
Really?
Downstairs, yeah. They sort of started the same time as we did, actually, interesting, which is probably why they gave it to us, because we were sort of... our society started in 1965. It was also in 65 that the government announced they were going to build a steel mill here. So over the next couple of years, that was being built. And I think they cast their first... but steel in 68-69.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
We head downstairs, and Richard seeks out a small area which displays a range of NZ Steel items, like an old work jacket, brochures, and finally a large, very heavy piece of steel,
which resembles a very large fishing sinker. There was a time when the mill was very open and commonly allowed groups through to view its inner workings. While this is no longer the case, Richard recalls a time he visited the mill, and his memory of what he saw, or what he didn't see, I found interesting and could have relevance to this case.
My brother worked there, and years ago, not long after he started, he showed me around the whole place, and that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I remember going there as a child, and it was just a whole city within a town.
Always amazed me is, in spite of the fact that they employ hundreds and hundreds of people, everywhere you went there, there was nobody, you didn't see anybody. There's a rolling mill there, and there's all the steel pouring out and turning into rolls, and you're looking around, there's nobody there. They're sitting in offices up above looking down, but you just don't see people there. Occasionally you see a truck drive past over in the distance going somewhere. But
just to remind you, there are people here.
Where they all are, I do not know, but it's so automated.
I'm a big fan of history and museums, and we spent a good hour and a half wandering around its rooms before we head outside and down to the edge of the water, where Richard shows me the stream, which is apparently the same as referenced in the Māori legend about the naming of the town.
Where the story is that Tamakai was, he would have been the higher land up here, it's where they were growing kumara, and he was working in the kumara fields, so the story goes, because he was the hard-working one of the two. The other brother, Tamakau, was the good-looking one, but not a very hard worker. Yeah, so when this high-ranking female from the Tainui came up here looking for a husband, she saw him first because he was the obvious choice, but she wasn't overly impressed, so they asked Tamakai to come down, and because he'd been working in the kumara fields just up the back here, he had to have a wash here with the wai and the uku, and she was impressed with him, so he won the girl,
and thus the town was named.
Given the town's great location on the waterfront and the history with the port, it's surprising that it never grew any larger than it did. The introduction of the railroad through New Zealand ultimately stunting any future growth. I felt when approaching this case, it was important to get a real understanding of Waiuku and its history, and my visit to the museum and Richard's vast knowledge of the area has certainly helped paint a picture of a town that has had to adapt to a changing world. Throughout its history, it's shifted its focus many times. As well as being a thriving port town, it was once home to the first major flax mill in New Zealand, which patented a new technology eventually used throughout all flax mills in New Zealand. Flax rope was the primary rope used for rigging during the age of sail. Eventually, steam engines replaced sails. The flax industry then collapsed, which leads to the current era of the town. In 1968, Waiuku became home to another pioneering mill, one which, for the first time anywhere in the world, would develop the technology to utilise the plentiful iron sands of New Zealand's west coast. That company, New Zealand Steel.
In 1949, this steel locomotive symbolised the state of technology. Today, New Zealand Steel use it to demonstrate the technological advances of their new colour steel G2 roof. So confident are they in the durability of G2's new pre-painting system, they will subject it to the ultimate test. The steel is bent. The paint remains unscathed. New colour steel G2. Steel yourself for the 21st century.
This famous 1994 advert demonstrates a locomotive driving over a single sheet of NZ Steel's latest and now biggest selling product, colour steel, which is essentially a pre-painted modern version of corrugated iron. The advert demonstrating the durability of the product, showing not a single scratch in the paint. At the time, the ad caused a stir, with many believing it was staged and simply not possible. NZ Steel then reproduced the test and was able to show to observers that the impossible was possible. Colour steel has stood the test of time and is now ubiquitous throughout New Zealand, but despite its wide reach, the origins of the product and the history of the company that produced it are largely a mystery to those who aren't themselves connected to the mill. And in many ways, NZ Steel likes it this way. Its story is integrated in the development of New Zealand as a self-reliant industrial nation, And while it was a groundbreaking venture from the start, sometimes to make a cake, you have to break a few eggs.
Today we can officially announce that New Zealand Steel has cracked the code. Through the fierce determination of Sir Wolf Fisher, New Zealand is the first country in the world to have made steel from sand.
The story of New Zealand Steel officially began in 1965. But to understand its real history, we need to go back 2.5 million years. The west coast of New Zealand is home to a unique type of black iron sand only found in a few places in the world, called titanomagnetite. First noted by Captain James Cook in 1769, these rich iron sands were created from volcanic rock deposits from the southern Taranaki region and transported via ocean currents, collecting in vast dunes up to 90 metres high along the beaches between Kaipara Harbour and Whanganui. From the late 19th century up to the 1950s, there were many unsuccessful attempts to smelt steel from the iron sands. That's despite a prize offered by the Taranaki provincial government, which was never claimed. The problem is that iron sand is full of impurities, and when the sand was heated to be processed, viscous slag like carbides and nitrides would form and block equipment. However, the New Zealand government recognised the potential benefits of having a national steel mill. At the time, New Zealand had to import a majority of its steel, which due to the isolated position of the country was slow and expensive. In 1954, the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research began investigating smelting from the iron sands, and in 1959, the New Zealand government officially established the NZ Steel Investigating Company under the Steel Industry Act 1959, and set their scientists the goal of achieving what at the time was considered impossible. The Franklin Times wrote on the 27th of July 1967, "The steelworks are a challenge of the highest order. It means a new future, a new outlook on the world." Eventually, the investigation showed promise, and in 1965, New Zealand Steel Limited was incorporated by the New Zealand government. And in 1967, construction started on a mill at Glenbrook, a couple kilometres north of Waiuku. The site chosen for its close location to the black sands of the Waikato North Head iron sand mine and the Huntly Power Station to the south. The driving force behind NZ Steel was New Zealand businessman and philanthropist Sir Wolf Fisher and NZ Steel Managing Director from 1969 to 1986, Sir John Ingram. Fisher, the name now made famous by the company he founded, Fisher & Paykel, lit the kiln for the first time 20th of November 1969. Initially, until this time, the company operated using imported raw steel. However, this changed when a world-first NZ Steel pioneered the direct reduction process for reducing iron oxide, iron sand, into metallic iron. This culminated in the commissioning of iron and steel making facilities to produce steel for both domestic and international markets. Such was the importance of the operation at the time that the Duke of Edinburgh and the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, visited in March 1970, where they were shown the finer points of the groundbreaking process of turning sand into steel. The company ran at a loss during the 1970s, until in 1981, a new, more optimized method for extracting iron was implemented, leading to an expansion of the facilities at Glenbrook. In 1987, New Zealand Steel was acquired by Equitacorp, but the stock market crash would not leave the mill unscathed, and after Equitacorp entered bankruptcy, it again changed hands, this time by the Hellenis Corporation, which ultimately led to the company being owned by BlueScope, which is currently listed on the Australian Securities Exchange. Today, NZ Steel is a massive operation, spanning over 500 hectares. It operates in many ways like a small city, with its own laundry service, medical centre and CAF. Everything the mill staff could need is provided on site. You can see a current map of the site and the companion post for this episode on my Instagram at RyanWolfNZ and our Facebook, Brevity Studios NZ. And as you would expect with an operation of this scale and intensity, accidents happen. It's not a matter of if, but when. The mill even has a sign at the front entrance, Days with No Incidents, with a small light board displaying the current number. The day I visited, 120. I spoke to retired former mill worker Dean Forsman, who described some of the working conditions and level of health and safety at the mill.
I was an oilerman in the rolling mills. Okay, that's just responsible for the oil and grease, lubrication and maintenance of machines within the rolling mills, which is one branch of New Zealand Steel. So there were different parts. There was the coating for colour coating for making. There was the making of the steel. Then there was the rolling of the steel. Then there was the production of the sort of the products of the steel. So yeah, there were lots of different. It was split into lots of different departments.
And how long did you work there for?
23 years, I think. 22 and a half, 23 years, yep. No, a very good employer.
Could you describe to me sort of what was the culture like at the mill in general?
Oh, no, really, really good. I came from a tourism background, so I was probably not the usual type of people that they had there, but they took me in really good and taught me, and no, very, very good. Couldn't speak more highly of the people and the mill itself.
Dean reiterates something you're going to hear a lot throughout this podcast. That is, employees that start working at the mill tend to stick and speak very highly of the mill as an employer. I asked Dean about the health and safety standards at the mill during the time he was employed. What was the mill? What was the sort of health and safety like? You know, I mean, I know things have changed a bit now, but
even then, I come from I grew up on a farm where a pair of gumboots and a t-shirt. Oh, the mill, you had glasses and gloves and hats and goggles, and they were very strict with their health and safety. It's probably even worse now, but no. Right from the start, from when I started, it was pretty strict on things like that.
They sort of, you feel like they would have a tabs on where people are at most times, and
yep. I'd be very surprised if they didn't.
Did you used to throughout the day? Would you have times you had to sort of check in and different things, or?
Well, I suppose with our group of three, we tried not to work alone in some parts, but we'd always touch base at morning tea, lunch or afternoon tea, and we were always probably within 100 metres of each other anyway. So
yeah,
but you know, they were quite strict about always being seen or not being alone, sort of.
Yeah. When you started there, is there quite sort of did you almost have to do like a safety course kind of thing?
Oh, yeah, inductions on all plants and for me, because I came from a totally not an engineering background, it was really, really good.
Yeah.
But each plant you went into, you had to do inductions about the safety hazards and of each plant. And I mean, yeah, there's lots of little plants within that big rolling mills, so it was quite intense, and they kept records. And
yeah, you certainly did. You wouldn't say they were lackadaisical in any way.
No, I think they were probably ahead of their times, maybe.
There's no doubt that in the 18 years since Jim's disappearance in 2004, workplace health and safety standards worldwide have changed drastically. I'd argue that in many industries they've shifted too far, to the point of adding unnecessary red tape and bureaucracy. But in the case of a 24-hour, 500-hectare steel mill, safety of staff couldn't be more important. However, it does seem that despite the occasional incident, safety at the mill was taken seriously, and they likely were ahead of their time. I'm focusing on this element of operation at the mill for reasons that will become more obvious as we move forward in this podcast. According to the police timeline, Dean was apparently the last person to ever see Jim alive on the morning of Monday, June 21st, 2004. But questions surround this sighting. We'll come back to hear more of what he remembers of that morning in an upcoming episode. But first, we need to revisit the most important element of the case, and that is the bizarre sequence of events which lead to Jim's disappearance, which have baffled the police, mill staff, Jim's friends and family to this very day, and which I believe hold the clues to finally uncover what happened to Jim Donnelly. Guilt is written, produced, and edited by me, Ryan Wolf. The title track is Nuclear Conception by Alison Winter. For further photos and video related to this episode, you can find a companion post on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ, or our Facebook page, Brevity Studios NZ. For ad-free listening and bonus content, you can subscribe for the price of a coffee on Apple Plus. You can also find further information on our website, www.theguiltpodcast.com. If you have any information related to the disappearance of Jim Donnelly or the subsequent search at the mill, you can contact us anonymously at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. On the next episode of Guilt.
So I've always been a South cop. I wasn't actually in the country when when Jim went missing. It's been a pretty big case. It's not the sort of thing that happens all the time. And the security guard that the mill had posted there, you know, bloody suspicious. The fact that the way it reversed away more than anything else. So just to put it into context for your listeners, you know, the his car was there. They've opened the boot. They've seen that there is a bag there with some clothes in it. And the security guard was posted. The car drove in late at night, but then seemed to freeze when the security guard made himself visible. And then the fact that it didn't just do a U-turn, you know, making itself highly visible as to what kind of car it was, registration numbers, having people in the car, the fact that it reversed back with the headlights on, is very suspicious behaviour.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.